This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I intended to speak on a different subject this evening, but as a result of an idea that was put to me after last night's shiur by Mr. David Tabak, that Eretz Yisrael should also form part of the series on the Kli and the content, that our relationship to Eretz Yisrael should be examined in the light of the same relationships that we've been examining over the past several weeks, I decided during the day that I would change the topic and deal with that. And in so doing, touch on three difficult medroshim. The first one, on the posuk Zois Ho'oretz Asher Tipo Lochem Benachalo, this is the land which will fall to you as an inheritance. The medrash questions, Mahu Lochem? Why the emphasis on the you? This is the land which will fall to you in inheritance. Lochem hi ru'uyo. It is fitting for you, says the Medrash. Moshol lemelech shehoyuloi avodim u'shefochos. It can be compared to a king who had servants and maidservants. V'hoyomisi la'avodov shefochos min usya acheres, v'lishefchosov avodim min usya acheres. And this king married off his manservants to maidservants from another household, and his maidservants to men servants from another household. Omad HaMelech v'choshuv b'dato. The king sat up for a while and thought in his mind. Omar, and he said, Ho'avodim sheli v'ashvochus sheli. The servants are mine and the maidservants are mine. Mutov she'asi avodai l'shifchosai. Sheli l'sheli. It is better that I should marry off my servants to my maidservants, mine with mine. Which is an interesting concept in Shidduchim altogether. Is it better to marry off like with unlike or like with like? Same backgrounds or different backgrounds? Different approaches. But the subject of the shiur is not Shidduchim this evening. And the Medrash carries on to say that the same applies to the Rebbeinu Shem, Kach ke biyochul omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so also said the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ha'oretz Sheli, the land, Eretz Yisrael, is mine. Shene'emar la'Hashem Ha'oretz. B'Yisrael Shelihem, and Yisrael are mine. As it says, Shene'emar kilivene Yisrael avodim. Mutav she'anchil arzi la'avadai sheli l'sheli. It is better that I should inherit my land to my servants, mine with mine. Akach ne'emar, that's why it says this is the land which shall fall to you in inheritance. The one Medrash. Strange and difficult to appreciate. What is the reason that the Medrash brings the image first of the slaves, the maidservants and the men servants? That the Medrash just said, the Ribbono Shel Olam felt that Eretz Yisrael being his own is a fitting land for the Jewish people who are his own. What is the Medrash adding with this image of marriage? The next Medrash immediately following. Zeshom al Akosuv. This is what the pasuk means when it says Koach Maisov Higid LaAmoy. The power of the deeds of the Ribbono Shel Olam, he is told to his people. And the pasuk goes on to say, Lo Seis Lohem Nachalas Goyim, to give them the inheritance of the nations. Omar Lohem Hakadosh Baruch Hu LiYisrael. The Ribbono Shel Olam said to Yisrael, Yochol Hoyisi Livreis Lohem Eretz Chadosho. I could have created a new country for you. I didn't have to give you a country that was already populated by others. I could have created a new country for you. Somewhat like the South African government did when it made Bantustan. Just make a new country. You don't have to give somebody else's country. Just make a new country. Declare it a country. But to show you my power, I rather kill those who hate you before you. And I give you their land, to give expression to that which is said, the power of his deeds, he has told to his people to give to them the inheritance of nations, Eretz Yisrael. Also a peculiar medrash. Sure, we understand the pasuk. The Ribbono Shel Olam wants, in giving us Eretz Yisrael, wants to show us the wonders of his deeds. Where does he demonstrate more wonder? In giving us a land which already exists and merely expelling the existing population and causing them to be killed in war? Or by creating a new land? Which would be more wonderful? Which would show Keach Ma'asav more? Which would demonstrate the wonders of the Ribbono Shel Olam's deeds? Imagine if when Eretz Yisrael needed a land, all of a sudden a new land appeared, an island in the Mediterranean with oil. All of a sudden, there it was. New place, you can have it. Wouldn't that be showing more the Keach Ma'asav? Wouldn't that demonstrate the Ribbono Shel Olam's wonders far more than having to go through wars and fights and slowly, little by little, conquer a land? So there's something very particular that the Medrash wants to teach us in the meaning of this posuk, Keach Ma'asav Higid Le'amre. What type of deeds, a specific type of deed, which could only be demonstrated through the expulsion and the conquest of those nations of Canaan from Eretz Yisrael? Those are the first two Midrashim that we need to deal with. That same posuk, Keach Ma'asav Higid Le'amre, Loses Lohem Nachalas Goyim, is the same posuk with which Rashi opens his Perush on Torah. In the very first posuk on the Torah, Rashi brings the Chazal, which asks, why does the Torah start with the whole story of the creation? The Torah is not a book of science, nor is it a book of history. It's a book of religion. It's a book of mitzvahs. And if it's a book of mitzvahs, it should start with the first mitzvah, HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem. That's where the Torah should start. How the world was created and the story, that should be left for the historians and the scientists to figure out. It's not really the subject of the Torah. That's what the Gemara asks. That's what Chazal asks. Answers Rabbi Yitzchok. Rashi brings it with this pasuk. Keach Ma'asav Higid Le'amo Loses Lohem Nachlas Goyim. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to reveal to us the power of his deeds to ensure that we would be able to acquire the inheritance of nations. Only this way did Hashem feel we would be able to inherit the land. Why, explains Rashi? Because when the nations will come and they will say, what right have you got to Eretz Israel to chase out all these Arabs and Canaanites? How can you do that kind of thing? It's not yours. Give it back. We will say, it's the Ribbono Shel Olam. It doesn't belong to the Arabs. It doesn't belong to us. The whole world belongs to the Ribbono Shel Olam. He made it. And he gives it to whom he pleases. A very difficult medrash altogether. That Chazal itself is also very difficult. Firstly, the difficulty is, well then what gives us the right to conquer it? Then the Arabs can use that time as well. How could you come in 1948? Hashem decides who it belongs to and he gave it to us. How can you come and take it from us? Did Hashem instruct you to do it? Were you operating by prophetic instruction? With what right did you come to conquer the land? Which is a claim, I suppose, not too distant from that being expressed even by the Natura character themselves. So finally, you can't have to take somebody else's land. Your only right to the land is that the Ribbono Shel Olam says it's mine and I give it to whom I want. Well, then you have to wait till he gives it to you. Or till he instructs you to go into war. Don't chase them out. They can keep it with the same claim that you had before. Quite a delicate claim. It's not so easy to push that aside. Be that as it may, that's the one difficulty. The second difficulty is a question that my daughter asked me when she learned that Rashi. The people who say that to us, the people that tell us we don't have any right to Eretz Yisrael, and we say to them, no, we do. Imagine we get up in the United Nations, we give a speech. This business, we say that the whole world wants us to get out of Eretz Yisrael, sorry, we don't accept it. But Ribbono Shel Olam made the land and he gave it to us. See, first Rashi and Seder Bereishis. Finish, sit down. What are they going to say? Oh, Taka, oh, sorry, we didn't know the first Rashi. It's okay, now you can have the land. What's it going to help? And I asked her to answer it. I asked her to think about the question and to answer it, and she gave the following answer. She says, it must be for us. They will always want us out of the land. They'll always tell us it's not ours. What we have to watch out for is the time when we start doubting ourselves whether we have a right to it. Then we're finished. And we need to be able to read the first Rashi and Bereishis and to remember and to realize that we have a right to it. It's the Ribbono Shel Olam who gave it to us, and that is our land. But we never forget who it belongs to. That's him, that's correct, that's what it's for. Be that as it may, there we see the pasuk of Keach Ma'asav, that the Ribbono Shel Olam tells us the power of his deeds, referring to which deeds?
the creation of the world. That creation from nothing is what is our basis of claim to any land which the Ribbono Shel'olam gives us. He created the world and He gave it to whom He will. So there we see the Koach Ma'asov referring in fact to creation ab initio. Whereas here all of a sudden we're looking at the same pasuk, Koach Ma'asov, being used to show the wonders of the Ribbono Shel'olam. What wonders? That He caused its Canaan to be conquered by the Jewish people. Those wonders, that's especially wonder done that way, rather than to create a new country altogether for us. What is peculiar about these maisim, about this deed of Hashem in giving us the land? So here we come to our third midrash. On the same pasuk, Zeis ha'oretz asher tipu lochem benachalo, asks the midrash here, the chi ha'oretz mefelis. What does it mean? This is the land which will fall to you in inheritance. Since when does the land fall? Ha'aloi kasiv ha'oretz lo'ilom oimedes, ha'oretz lo'ilom oimedes. Land stays there forever. It's Israel stays there. It doesn't fall anywhere. Ella, what it means is the following. And the Midrash tells us the background to the whole episode. Kishibur hamiragli, when the spies came back from spying out the land of Israel, v'hitziyo dibo al horitz, and they spoke badly of Eretz Israel, koas aleihem Moshe. Moshe got angry with him. Omru lo kol Yisrael, but all the nations said to Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu, if there were only two or three spies that you said, well, good, we would have had to believe them. Because it says, with two or three witnesses, you've got to believe them. So we sent out kosher witnesses, they spied the land, and they came back with a report. We've got to believe them. But there are 10 of them. Where are we going to go to? Achenu hem osu es levovenu. Our brothers have melted our hearts. Lemur telling us, Am godol v'rom mimenu. This is a mighty nation, much too high for us. Kib yochol, implying, so to say, in balabais yochol itzikelov mishom. The owner can't get his own furniture out of there anymore. They've taken it over. The Ribbono Shel'olam can't handle it. It's too powerful for anybody. Me osu HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What did the Ribbono Shel'olam do? They had a good claim. They sent in witnesses. And the witnesses came back with a bad report. And the Tiferet Tzion comments here very brilliantly, but what do they do with Yeshua and Kolev? After all, Yeshua and Kolev were also two witnesses. And the din is that 10 witnesses don't carry more weight than 2 witnesses. 2 witnesses tell us one thing, and 100 witnesses tell us another. We regard them as 2 against 2. 2 is the maximum. There's nothing clearer than 2 witnesses. And therefore, what is the basis of their claim? They believe the 10, but there were 2 against them. They should have realized that there's something wrong. Explains the Tiferet Tzion that when the 2 and the 10 are not arguing about facts, they are arguing about interpretation of the facts, there you have to follow the majority. So the 2 didn't come along and say that the cities were not fortified, the people were not giants and were not strong. The 2 didn't say that. The 2 said everything the 10 said is true, but we will beat them. That's a matter of opinion, really. The facts, there's no argument about. Say, B'nai Yisrael, 10 of them have expressed an opinion that we don't stand a chance. These are the experts we chose. You can't choose experts, and when you don't like the report they come back with, you decide they're not experts anymore. You can't do that kind of thing. If you choose the experts, you've got to abide by their decision. And the majority decision of the 12 experts that we sent was that we will not be able to conquer this land. And therefore they had quite a strong claim. B'nai Yisrael had quite a strong claim.
What did the Ribbono Shel'olam do? Notal sar ho'oretz. Now the Midrash takes a Kabbalistic excursion. He took the sar, the angel of the land. I'll still explain that in a few minutes. Ukefosoi, and he tied him up. Vehipilo lifnehem, and he threw him down in front of the Bnei Yisrael. Shenehmar, as it says, Re'ei si, noson Hashem lekech lefonecho es ho'oretz.
Hashem has thrown the land before you. Bechilif Neim Hoysos is the Medrash. Was the land in fact in front of them at that time? El Ashehipil Soro, but it was the angel of Eretz Yisrael that he threw before them. The Oimei Elohim, and he says to them, Ali Reish, go and conquer Al Tiro Val Techas, do not fear and do not be afraid. Loimin Anafilim, not from the giants, the Loimin Amrov, and not from the multitudes of people. Medrash goes on further to say, "Ban imim bizechus ha-Torah," and this was done with the merits of Torah. What does all that mean? What is the meaning of this Kabbalistic excursion? The Ribbono Shel Olam's maisim, the creations of the Ribbono Shel Olam, need to be seen in two different areas. The one is Maisei Bereishis, the creations ex nihilo that took place in the 6 days of Bereishis, where the Ribbono Shel Olam from nothing made the world. That's stage one of the creation. But there's another entire aspect of creation, which is Hamechadesh Bechol Yoim Tomid Maisei Bereishis, that the Ribbono Shel Olam is continually renewing the act of creation. And that's a different kind of creation. In the case of the 6 days of Bereishis, before Hashem began his work, there was nothing. And 6 days later, there was everything. Now there's everything. And yet Hashem is continually creating, we're told. It's an ongoing process. The creation is taking place at all times. What is the understanding of that creation? This all ties to the concept of Ishtalshulutz, which we've discussed several times before, and which the ladies are learning with me on Friday morning in the Derech Hashem, where we must see the creation somewhat like an electric light bulb or an electric heater. It needs to be plugged in. And as long as it's plugged into the electricity, it works. The moment it's no longer plugged into the electricity, or there's a stoppage in the flow of electricity, it ceases to work. In other words, there's an outer shell of a thing here, and it is connected to a source of energy which can be many miles away. And as long as there's energy flowing from that powerful source to the light bulb or to the electric heater, we're able to receive light and to receive heat. The moment that ceases, the light stops, and the heat stops. Now, in the normal world in which we live, the heater doesn't stop to exist. It's still there. And the light bulb is still there, just that it doesn't operate as a light bulb and it doesn't operate as a heater. In the spiritual world, the same applies. Every atom, every molecule of matter is attached to a source of energy in the upper worlds of Shemayim. Every molecule. By the whole process of Ishtalshulus, it's an electric type of connection, so to say, linked, link by link, all the way back to the source of power, to the source of energy, which is the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. And the Ribbono Shel Olam is continuously feeding energy to every molecule of the Bria. Should the Ribbono Shel Olam kibiyochol chas v'sholom for one moment stop feeding energy to that molecule, then it's not like the electric heater where it remains and the heater just doesn't work. When the Ribbono Shel Olam stops supplying energy to that molecule ceases to exist. Because that molecule is nothing but the energy supplied by the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what it is. It takes on a physical form. Just as energy can be changed to matter, so spiritual energy can be changed to matter, but if the energy is not there, the matter is not there. Everything ceases to exist. And that's the concept of Ein Oyud Milvado. There is nothing in the world but the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if the Ribbono Shel Olam ceases, so to say, feeding continuously every moment, Tom Mid, without a break, then that which he was feeding ceases to exist when he stops to feed. That's the hashpo, the influence, the flow of energy from the Ribbono Shel Olam to the Olam. And that's partly what is meant by our understanding of Hamechadesh Betuvoy Bechol Yom Tomid Maaseh Bereishis, that the Ribbono Shel Olam, with his goodness, renews continuously and daily the Maaseh Bereishis, continuously feeding him. It's not a one-off thing. It's not that when you turn on the light, now there's light, and now you can unplug it, but you've made the light, it's there, it can stand on its own. It can never be detached from its source of energy. That light is created by the process of feeding it with energy. And if you stop the energy, the light stops. So the whole Bria, the whole Olam, is created out of the Ribbono Shel Olam's energy. Stop the energy, and the world ceases to exist. Let's take Eretz Yisrael. The Meraglim come back and they report about the state of the land. And the report they give is a very worrying one. The report they give is of a powerful land, manned by powerful people, with powerful armies and powerful arsenal, fortified, strong and impregnable. A very worrying picture they paint. The two men, Yeshua and Kalev, see a different picture. The facts they see is the same, but they don't envisage any difficulty in conquering it. Very different interpretations. All 12 men were experts in their field, otherwise they wouldn't have been chosen. And we get such two contradictory interpretations of the facts. Both see the same facts. There's no argument on that. But 10 of the 12 see those facts resulting in annihilation of the Jews, despite the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam would help them. The miracles would need to be so enormous that it wouldn't be permitted to rely on such miracles. And two of them see no difficulty. They don't see a problem. Why not?
Explains the Medrash. The Ribbono Shel Olam took down the Sar. The Sar is part of the chain between the source of energy and the final expression down here in this world. Everything has a Sar upstairs. Everybody has everything, every person, every nation has a Sar, an angel, a force of energy, a link upstairs in Shemayim, through which that energy is channeled from the Ribbono Shel Olam down to this earth. The Ribbono Shel Olam takes the Sar of Eretz Yisrael and he throws it down at the feet of the Jewish people and he says, there Eretz Yisrael is before you. What does that mean? It means that the container has no content. I have removed the content of Eretz Yisrael. It's an empty vessel. Now, empty vessels are interesting things because a vessel is never really empty unless you create a vacuum inside it. And if you create a vacuum inside it, what happens? It collapses. Because a utensil is designed to withstand equal pressure on the inside and the outside. Or if it's a special utensil, it will be designed to handle more pressure on the inside or the outside. If it's a utensil which is designed to handle a vacuum, then it will be designed in a way where it can handle more pressure from outside. And if you remove the pressure from outside, what happens then? It's designed to push against the outside, and if you remove the pressure, if you create a vacuum outside of it, it explodes. And likewise, a utensil which is designed to handle greater pressure inside it, if you then create a vacuum inside it, it will also collapse. There's too much pressure on the outside. So a kli is designed, apart from all the other relationships of kelim, of utensils that we've discussed over the past several weeks, a kli is also designed to handle a particular proportion of pressure on the inside and on the outside. And if that proportion alters too radically, the kli weakens. Let us examine a kli, a utensil, which is designed to handle an enormous amount of pressure from outside. So it's created resistant to pressure from outside, rather than to pressure from inside. I suppose things like submarines and things like kalim like that, which are designed to operate in areas of very heavy pressure pressing in on it from the outside. What does one do when one realizes, if you look at a utensil and you analyze the utensil and you see this utensil is designed to stand up to a lot of pressure from outside? What happens then if one creates a vacuum on the inside, altering the pressure ratios? So it can take, it's designed to take pressure from outside. Why? Because, let's take it a little differently. That must immediately indicate that the pressure inside the utensil is less than the pressure outside. Must be. If the pressure was the same, you don't need all this fortification to keep the thing together. So if you look at a vessel, if you look at a utensil or at a craft, and you see it's designed to tolerate enormous pressure from the outside, you know that the pressure inside is less. The Meraglim go to Eretz Canaan, and what do they see? They see a nation designed to handle enormous pressure from the outside. Great fortifications, enormous arsenal. What does that indicate? They say that indicates a jolly hard battle ahead of us. In fact, an impossible battle.
The Meraglim, the other two Meraglim, Kolev and Yoshua, they laugh. That indicates it's empty inside. If there was pressure inside as well, they wouldn't need such fortification.
That's a point which Rachav HaZoino realizes very, very clearly some years later, where the two spies of Yoshua go to visit Rachav, you'll remember. And those spies handled the whole operation in a different way. They didn't go to analyze and to examine the arsenal. They didn't go to examine the army camps and to spy on the army to see what kind of army it was. Where did they go? They went to the bars and to the inns to listen to people speaking, to understand the state of the spirit of the nation. And Rachav says to them, don't worry, the spirit of this nation is broken. It's a walkover for you. It doesn't matter how powerfully we are armed. That's irrelevant. The degree of the power of our armory is in fact an expression of the weakness of our spirit. We all know you're going to beat us. And they go back to Yeshua with the right analysis and with the right understanding.
It's a point that is one of the underlying themes of Tolstoy's War and Peace. How he interprets the whole battle between France and Russia, where the French had by far the more powerful army, the more brilliant general, the more outstanding tactics, everything was in favor of them. Except he, writing from a Russian viewpoint, claims one thing they didn't have. They didn't have the spirit that the Russian people had. And that's what determines, in the final analysis, that's what determines the effectiveness of the army. I remember as a child in Eretz Yisrael, I used to often make a point of going. In those days on Yom HaTzma'ut, they used to have these army parades. They used to take out all the tanks and the aeroplanes. It was a very impressive parade. It used to be exciting, and I used to try and go to see it, sneak out of the yeshiva and go and watch it. And I remember standing there once, feeling very excited, and then all of a sudden stopping myself and saying, but this must be the kind of thing that the Meraglim saw when they came. This is a Canaanite demonstration. This is not an Eretz Yisrael demonstration. If you have to demonstrate your arsenal, you're exposing your weakness. If you're saying, this is our koach, this is our power, this, look what we've got. Anybody with seichel has to say, why do you need so much? That means there's more pressure outside than there is inside. This is a kli designed to withstand enormous pressure from outside. You don't show that off. That's the kind of thing you keep away from spies. You don't want them to see how powerful your army is. There should be an inner strength of spirit, and that was always the strength of Israel until very recently. And their main pride was the spirit of the army and the spirit of the fighting man and the Mesiras Nefesh for Eretz Israel, the willingness to die, right until the time of the Yom Kippur War, and even worse, during the Lebanon War, where that spirit began to be broken, where people were no longer ready to die to the same extent as they were before. That's when we started having problems. The army is probably a lot more powerful now than it ever was before. But that doesn't make us feel better. The fighting spirit is not what it was before. The difference between the two spies and the 10 spies is that the two spies looked at the content and they realized that to estimate the strength of a utensil, you can't just look at the utensil. You have to look at the utensil and the pressures on it from inside and outside. Because even a strong utensil, if the pressures from outside or inside are not proportionate to the way it was designed, that utensil will collapse. And the two spies realize that right away. Yeshua and Kalev realize right away, as strong as the kli is, it indicates an emptiness on the inside. And therefore this is going to be easy to handle. The 10 spies looked only at the arsenal, they looked only at the kli, only at the utensil. They didn't examine what was inside the utensil. The Midrash goes on to say, where we see this concept expressed so clearly, Yesh odom shehu noe ulevushu kiyu. Sometimes you see very nice people and they're dressed very badly. It's not right. There's an incongruity about it. Hu kiyu ulevushu noe. Sometimes you see very ugly people but they have a good sense of dress. Also a little bit incongruous. The Yisrael heim noim laoretz. That the Jewish people are fitting to the land and the land is fitting to them. Once again we see the kli and content, the kli and tochen relationship. Eretz Yisrael is the clothing, the Jewish people is the body inside the clothing. This difference in perspective, we've been learning in the Ladies Shir is part of the argument that has been taking place between Eev, who has such enormous philosophical difficulties that perplex him no end, and that perplex him no end, and Sofer HaNaamosi, one of the three friends who are debating with him, and Sofer doesn't see it the way Eev does. Eev comments over and over again how easy the wicked have it and how tough the righteous have it. And although he's prepared to concede that when it comes to the righteous, you don't always know that it is righteous and it isn't righteous, but he says there are people who are clearly wicked. One can see from everything they say and from everything they do, there's no question that they're wicked. And they have a good life. And one of Sofer's attacks on Eev is that you can't judge a person's well-being by his external circumstances. Same concept. You can't look at a kli just by examining the kli. Say, look, it's gold, it's beautiful, it's wonderful. Depends on the precious. Precious inside, precious outside. You can't even look at a kli and judge it in the context of the precious outside it. You can't look at one utensil and say, well, this utensil is very fortunate. It has no pressure outside. It just lives in an ordinary environment. That's fine if you know for sure that it has no pressure inside either. Then the kli is safe. But you can't look at the outside and say, look, no pressure from the outside, when there might be very heavy pressure from the inside, and that can cause the kli to shatter. You've got to look at the inside. And so Sofer gives various examples, one we've quoted in the shir already, lachmoy b'meyov ne'epoch, the bread inside his stomach turns into unhealthy sources of what should have been nourishment. And so he goes on. And he makes the comment, ki lo yodo sholei bevitno. As much as he eats, he doesn't know what it's like to have a satisfied stomach. As Shlomo HaMelech says, beten roshoyim techsa, that the stomach of the rosha of the wicked person is always empty. It doesn't matter how much he eats. You've got to look at the inside too. You look at the man and you see his table set beautifully, and any amount of food, absolutely no shortage. So you assume that he's a satisfied man. But the truth is the opposite. If a man needs so much food, that must be there to compensate him for internal inadequacies. It's the man who doesn't have so much food on his table that you should look at and say, ah, he's lucky. He doesn't need to be eating all the time. He's got other compensations. He's self-satisfied. He's inside. He's feeling fully self-contained. He doesn't need the experience of eating in order to feel satisfied. Ein sorid lachloi, the wicked person says, Sofer leaves nothing on the table, he eats it all up, trying to get as much quantity as he can. Arkein lo yochil tuvoi, therefore his goodness isn't successful. That's not the way to achieve a feeling of well-being. I've mentioned to you, not to say the one is tzaddik and the one is rosho, but the difference in eating habits between the continentals and the Americans. You know, to an American restaurant or eating establishment, one can hardly call them restaurants, you get enormous quantities of food piled onto your... Even Americans can't finish it. South Africans certainly can't finish it. And Europeans don't know what to do with it. But even Americans don't finish it. And the doggy bag comes with it. You get the food and the doggy bag. It's part of the deal. It's expected that you're going to take home. You're not going to manage to finish it. And you go to Europe, and you walk into a restaurant there. You can call it a restaurant. And you pay six times the amount that you pay in America. And you get a little portion, tiny little portions, beautifully made and exquisitely styled on gorgeous china, just a little bit. You taste it, it's something exceptional, absolutely exceptional. You go to America and you buy a chocolate and they give you a huge chunk of a slab wrapped in, that's it. You get a big slab, a bigger slab, a very big slab. You go to England and you ask for the chocolate, you go to Europe and you ask for the chocolate, what do they say? You want one or two, how many do you want? So you're expecting a slab, so you say, one's enough, thank you. And they see that you're there with your wife, and they say, for the two, you just one. You say, yes, one's enough, thank you. And they take a little truffle, the size of a ping pong ball, and they wrap it up gorgeously, and you pay five times as much as you would have for the bar in America, and they say, here's your chocolate. You taste that chocolate, my goodness, what taste it is. It's almost worth going to Europe just for that. Different aspects. What causes the satisfaction, the quality or the quantity? That Sofer, don't judge by quantity. The man who needs a lot is very empty, and he's empty after he's had the lot as well, because the human being doesn't become satisfied from quantity. That does not satisfy the soul. Quantity can satisfy a body, but it cannot satisfy a soul. So animals can become satisfied with quantity. Human beings can't. And all this business that they've made with dog food, you remember this, the gravy and this flavor and that flavor, it makes no difference to the animals at all. Absolutely no difference. All the difference that it makes to the animals is how much. You try reducing the quantity and telling him this is a European restaurant. You have to make your dog, tell your dog he has to make do with just a little portion because this, the gravy, is really very excellent, very special gravy. He's not going to buy that. He wants the quantity and he doesn't care about the taste. As long as it's royal achilas kelev, it just has to be something which, as the halacha says, is just fit for the dog, then he'll eat it, no matter what it is. Human being, not. He expects there to be a certain taste.
I think I told you also once that in yeshiva, soon after I got there, it was in Gateshead, and the food was terrible and was getting worse and worse. And it was my first year in yeshiva, and I just wasn't used to it. So I tried complaining a little bit, didn't work. I tried to try and organize a bit of a revolt, that didn't work. I tried to use my influence with the Rosh Yeshivas, who were, I was fortunate enough to be my cousins and uncles, and that didn't work. And eventually I thought the only thing that's going to work in this place is a halachic approach. So I took a bowl of food over to the Rosh Yeshiva across the road, and I said, I've come to ask a shaila. He said, what is the shaila? I said, I want to know whether one can make a brocha on this or not. So I said to him, I can't eat it. I don't know what to say. I said, I can't eat it, because to eat it I have to make a brocha, and it's a sofek brocha. I don't know whether I can. But you're in the middle of lunch already. You've washed and you've made your brochas, so you can taste it. So why don't you taste it and tell me if I can make a brocha? He took a taste of it and marched into the yeshiva, into the kitchen, to the cook, and there was quite a to-do. But he then called some boys from the senior shiur, and he said to them, what do you think about the food? And they said, Rosh Yeshiva, we don't come to yeshiva for food. We come for Torah, and the food really doesn't make any difference. As long as it's there and we've got what to eat, that's fine. To which his answer was, I'm teaching Torah to human beings, not to angels. This is not the place for you, if that's the way you feel. It's got to be a bit of humanity as well. A human being needs quality in everything he does. There's no point in going meshuggah on the quality at the expense of everything else, certainly on the quality of physical and material things. But once one's doing it, there is such a need. There's quality. A thing needs to be presentable. It needs to have good taste. That's part of kovod habrius. To dish something up to a person which is unpalatable, that's not kovod habrius. That's not honor to a human being. And so there has to be this delicate relationship in all that we do between the content, the kli, the container, and the content. The content has to have something to it. And so it says, so far, don't judge the prosperity of Rishoyim by the quantity that they have. The quantity, on the contrary, is an indication of the inadequacy of the person, not of the adequacy. And in the next chapter, Eve himself paraphrases Tzofa's claim and says, I know what you're going to say to me, but you won't find righteous people living in houses of stone, and you won't find wicked people living in tents. What he means to say is, a wicked person lives in a house of stone, and it's a righteous person who lives in a rickety shackle, in a rickety ramshackle sort of place. Why? Because a Rosha feels insecure and he needs stone with security gates and dogs and alarm systems, then he feels secure. Tzaddik doesn't need it. That his security doesn't come from the stones. Little house, not all that secure, but it's fine, it's okay. Says Eev, I know that's what you're going to claim, that I should not be judging the prosperity of people by the homes in which they live. On the contrary, the more solid the home, the more inadequate is the person, if you're looking at him from the inside. And Sefer himself says, in referring to the Ribbono Shel Olam's handling of people, that when the Rosha has to flee from warfare and from aggression, eventually Hashem catches up with him. Sholaf Hashem draws his sword, Vayetzei Migevor, but Hashem has a funny sword. Most swords come from the outside and they pierce the skin and then they go inside. Hashem's sword comes from the inside and it pierces the skin from the outside and sticks out. Vayetzei Migevor. The blade of Hashem's sword comes from inside the body. When Hashem punishes, he deals with the toichen. He deals with the inside, not with the outside. And this is a whole different way of looking at the world. If we're going to analyze the world looking at the kelim, we're going to get a very distorted picture. Because if we look at the kelim, then the Jewish people have no right to be here at all. Any historian and any sociologist will show that in terms of the pressures on the people, if you look at the outside pressures, there's no way we could have survived. It's not possible. No other nation has ever survived with far less pressures on the outside. But what they fail to do is to look at the inside pressures. The outside pressures alone are meaningless when you're analyzing the strength of a utensil.
It doesn't help saying there are enormous outside pressures, therefore this kli is going to collapse. If the inside pressures are equal to the outside pressures, then there is no pressure at all.
And the historians and the sociologists and the politicians are not capable of analyzing the internal pressures of the Am Yisrael, how much there is inside the Jewish people. That's not their subject. They only deal with the kli. They only deal with the external. They only deal with the utensil and outward, not with what's inside the utensil.
And you too, Eev, says Tzofar. You're only analyzing what's outside, his house and his security and all sorts of things outside, how much food he's got, how much money he's got. That's irrelevant. What you've got to look at is how much strength there is inside. And the more strength there is inside, the lesser the kli he needs to protect himself from the outside pressures. If the two pressures are equal, then a very flimsy kli will do the trick. He can live in an oyel. He can live in a tent. He doesn't need a building if the pressures inside match up to the pressures outside. And that's the art and the skill of a life of Torah. To be able to put pressure inside, to be able to fill the kli with content in such a way that it can withstand all these pressures.
So the Ribbono Shel Olam says to Am Yisrael when they come and they say, we've got to believe the ten, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, the ten were reporting on the kli. And they're right. The utensil is powerful. The ten were reporting on the fact that this utensil is designed to withstand enormous pressure from the outside. That's true. But if you look in the inside, here is the Sar Shel Eretz Yisrael lying before you. There is no inside. The content is completely vacant. There is a vacuum inside. And if there's a vacuum inside, all that force on the outside doesn't help. You can blow those walls down. It's so easy if you understand that there's nothing inside.
That being the case, we can understand with a little bit more clarity the first Midrash. Before I do that, let me see that we've understood clearly the second Midrash. That's what it means. That Yochel Hoyisi Livrois Lochem Eretz Chadosho. I could have created a new land for you, given you a new kli. Elo bishvil laharis lochem es koichi.
But I wanted to show you my unique energy. Not just the energy with which I created the world, but the energy with which I continue to create the world. Which is the energy of relating to the inside rather than to the outside. To the content rather than to the container. The container I created at the 6 days of creation. That was it. There's the container. The kli is there. But that doesn't mean the kli is going to last. I've got to be balancing pressures all the time. And that's the unique koach I wanted to show you. That when the nation has become degenerate, when Eretz Canaan became degenerate, they became vacant from any kind of pressure inside.
And I therefore am hoireg esoneichem, mipneichem. By removing the spiritual force that fed Eretz Yisrael, that fed Eretz Canaan, by removing that force, the Kabbalistic image of bringing down the Tsar and throwing him before you. I kill your enemies before you, v'noisen lochem es artzon. And you can conquer that land and you can put content into that land and build it up from the inside rather than from the outside.
And so too the image of the marrying off of the slaves and the maidservants is again the image of the Duchra and the Nukra, the male, female, content, container. Sometimes it's good for the container and the content to be different, for the male and female poles of the relationship to come from different parts, to be very different. And the Medrash is explaining to us that a human being's relationship to his environment is like a marriage relationship. The environment demands certain things from the individual and he has to put certain things into his environment. And sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam, at first the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted us dispersed throughout the nations so that the input we put would be worldwide and we would have an impact over the whole world. And thereafter, the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted us back in Eretz Yisrael, like by like. There are two kinds of marriages. A young man from Bnei Brak can marry a young girl from Bnei Brak and live in Bnei Brak all their lives. That's one kind of marriage, and it's a very wonderful marriage. And it's a marriage, if the families are fine families, which is not a necessity if they come from Bnei Brak, any more than from any other place. And every place one finds fine people, and one finds less fine people. But if one comes from an environment like Yerushalayim, in certain areas of Yerushalayim or Bnei Brak, and the boy comes from there, and the girl comes from there, and they live there from fine families, that's likely to be a relationship of a great deal of sanctity, of Kedusha and Taro. It can be another relationship when a boy from Bnei Brak marries a girl from Timbuktu. That's a different kind of relationship, also capable of being very exciting, but not assured of the same degree of Kedusha or Taro.
And you'll remember in the first shiur of this series, we discussed the two aspects of clothing. And we're back now to clothing and the environment being the clothing. The aspect of Big Day Tiferes, that the clothes of the Kohanim were lechovered ule tiferes. On the one hand, they had to be for external communication, to communicate glory and honor. On the other hand, it was lekadsho lechanoili. They had to be kedusho and purpose, a sense of purpose and purity in the creation of those clothes. Two aspects. And so the Ribbono Shel first had Yisrael outside, in the world, interrelating with the world. And that's our role in Golus, in the exile. That's our role, is to interrelate and to teach and express and stand for the principles of Torah in whatever environment we find ourselves, thereby enriching the environment. But there comes a time when he wants us back, a kadshu l'chaim, really, in a more closed environment, in a more secure environment, where the environment has a great deal to give to us, a great deal of sanctity and a great deal of purity. But the relationship is one of person to clothing. In this shiur, therefore, we're really able to wind up the series in our understanding of how the Ribbono Shel Olam views the world from his vantage point, so to say, and therefore how he expects us to view it. Not to be taken up with the appearance of the container without appreciating the content. Not to be taken up with the content without appreciating the strength of the container. If the content is very powerful and the container is too weak, the content will be spilt, it will be dissipated. If the content is there but the external pressures are enormous, then again the container will be dissipated. In all situations, if we want to analyze a situation, it's necessary for us to examine the caliber of the container and the caliber of its content and of its environment. And only those three factors can give us a proper picture of what it really is. When we talk about a person standing before an Nisoyon, an individual who has to find himself in a trying situation, will he be able to take it? Won't he be able to take it? You can't say, well, so-and-so did it last year and he was okay. Not necessarily so. This is a new person, new situation, with a different kind of insight. And to realize that the Jewish way to victory is not through stronger kelim. That's not the way. The Jewish way to victory is to balancing the pressures, to making sure that when there's a great deal of pressure from outside, there's still more content, there's still more pressure on the inside. And that's the way our kelim creates demands on us. If the kli really insulated us from the effect of all pressures, we wouldn't be forced into the situation of having to increase the pressures inside us. It's because we find ourselves in threatening situations, and that our kli, that our material framework is relatively weak, and we don't place a great deal of store by that, we know that that's not going to stand up to the pressures, and that the only thing that's going to really stand up to the pressure is how much pressure we create within ourselves. That way, the more pressure there is from the outside, the more pressure there is from the inside. And likewise, when we find more pressure on the inside, we have to create more pressure on the outside. A simple example that we live with every day. If an individual finds himself in a spiritually hostile environment, in an environment which is unclean and impure and dishonest, and he cannot get away from it, his bo'inus, that's where he is, and that's where he's got to be right now, what is his defense? Not just a stronger kli. That doesn't work. Because we discussed the laws of Tumah and Tahara 2 weeks ago and last week. And Tumah is not particularly concerned about how thick the walls of the kli are. A utensil can have very thick walls, it makes no difference. The walls can be 10 meters thick, and the Tumah goes all the way through. It just doesn't matter. Tumah goes, penetrates right through the walls of the kli. And so we're not going to protect ourselves from an environment by creating thicker walls. The way we're going to protect ourselves, as we said, watch the shaykhs inside. Purify the content. Create greater spiritual content and greater spiritual pressure inside. That's the way we'll counteract it. And contrarywise, when one finds oneself building pressure inside oneself, raising oneself and improving oneself, and all of a sudden one looks at one's environment, and it's not up to scratch. One can't relate. There's a lack of congruity there. The content and the outside just don't match up. It's time to demand more of one's environment. It's time to raise the standards of one's environment. And that's how a Jewish society operates. If individuals always filling up the container and demanding more from the surroundings. Improving the surroundings, demanding more content in the container. When a community raises its standards, it is inevitable that each person has to raise his standards inside himself. We're talking about not external standards. It doesn't help raising external standards. That's the kli, that's making the kli thicker. To act more frum. It doesn't help. When the community raises its standard, that places pressure on the person to raise the content, the inside of his spiritual level. And when an individual in a community raises his spiritual standard, that in turn places pressure on the whole community to raise their standard, to raise its standard. And that interrelationship is always taking place.
And also important in the expression of these concepts is the understanding that we have to do that which we're best at. It's no point trying to do things which aren't suited to our own personalities, to our own characters. Because at the end of the day, our success is going to depend on the content, not on the container. And one can teach a person all sorts of skills, but a person doesn't improve himself by skills alone. The skills are the container, and without the skills, the content can't be protected. One needs skills. You can have wonderful thoughts, but if you don't know how to speak, you can't do anything with those thoughts, and eventually the thoughts become sterile. You need the skills of speaking. One can be a wonderful doctor that knows all sorts of wonderful things, but if you don't know the skills of how to use that information, if one doesn't know the skills of medical practice, that medical information becomes useless and eventually becomes sterile. Of course one needs the skills, but the skill is the kli. And the skills don't make one a better person. A better doctor is not necessarily a better person. Just as a better lawyer or a better plumber is not a better person. A great doctor is not necessarily a great man. A great scientist, a great artist is not necessarily a great man. All that means is a great kli, a great utensil. That in analyzing how great the whole thing is, one has to analyze the relationships of inside pressures with outside pressures. And if we realize that our success depends on what we're able to generate inside ourselves, we have to see that we're operating in the kind of area where we can generate from within inside ourselves. There's no point in us using our kalim, using our skills in areas where we can't put the content in. Each person has a unique character. Each person is creative. Each person can fill his container up with the most remarkable content. And he can keep on doing it. He can keep on generating and creating day after day after day. He need never stop. Provided he's not trying to imitate. When one tries to imitate, when there's a lack of genuineness, when there's a lack of originality, when there's a lack of understanding that it's me who has to generate, it has to come from inside the clear, not from outside. From inside it has to come. I have to generate it. When there's that understanding, there's no end to how much can be created and how much can be developed. If we're merely going to try to imitate one another and all try to do the same things, we're going to find enormous pressure on the outside and very little pressure on the inside to enable that to be withstood. And that's where the area of fear comes in. One fears when one feels that the kli is going to collapse. And one feels one can't cope. What does it mean you can't cope? That means the pressures outside are greater than the pressures inside. Or sometimes the opposite. Occasionally it means the pressures inside are greater than the pressures outside, but that's rare, let's not even discuss it. Normally it means I can't cope. Why? The pressures are too great. Too great for what? Too great not for my kli, because the kli is irrelevant. What have we said? We've got to look at the proportions. When a person has that feeling, I can't cope, it doesn't help necessarily taking the pressures from outside away. That might be a temporary solution. What needs to be done is the pressures inside need to be built up. That is an indication, that's a symptom of a lack of content. Time to learn a little bit more, time to think a little bit more, to spend more time with oneself, to improve oneself a little bit more, to generate, to become a little bit more creative, and then all of a sudden one can cope again with the same situation, no difficulty. How often is it that we find people in a state of depression, unable to cope, and one finds them a few months later in much worse situations, with much more pressure, coping beautifully, absolutely beautifully, ready to take on even more. The outside pressures have remained the same or have gotten worse. What's happened? The inside pressures have gotten stronger. And as the pressure inside the kli builds up, so the pressure outside can be coped with. The Meraglim saw Eretz Yisrael, and they saw an enormous kli, thick walls, capable of withstanding enormous pressure from the outside. What they didn't realize is that when there's no pressure inside, then all the pressure that it's of the kli, all the ability of the kli to withstand pressure from the outside doesn't help. They can't cope.
If the inside isn't there, if there's no spirit there, if there's no soul there, if there's no neshama, if there's no inner excitement and creative drive, then eventually those walls fall down. One only has to wait a little bit. And that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to teach us. Koyach Ma'asov Higid Le'amo. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to teach us how he operates. That the Jewish people, with no army, with no equipment, with no tanks and with no airplanes, can smash that impregnable Canaan merely by differences in pressure, by fighting with their content rather than with their container, fighting against the emptiness of the nations of Canaan rather than against their impressive armory, their impressive kelim. When one deals content to content, we find the Jewish person is able to come out on top, provided it's bizchus ha-Torah, provided he himself is filled with the schus of Torah.